This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. 2 years into a global pandemic, Atlantic staff writer Ed Young has observed a Sisyphean cycle of panic and neglect in how America has dealt with COVID, characterized by the nixing of a $15 billion relief measure last month.
There was disagreement, including among the Democrats, over how to pay for COVID funding. And that has forced the House leadership to pull the COVID money out of the rest of the bill and then try to pass them separately.
This week, a scramble to save $10 billion in COVID relief met with much the same fate. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer.
Republicans voted no on vaccines for kids. Republicans voted no on tests for new COVID variants. Republicans voted no on therapies to save lives and make us less sick. Have we learned nothing from the last 2 years of living with this horrible disease? Have Republicans learned nothing about how lack of preparation could damage our economy?
To casual observers, and certainly less casual ones like Ed Young, they have not.
What we've seen throughout the pandemic is that neglect phase has repeatedly set in while the pandemic has actually been going on. We haven't even got to the moment of calm when the threat is over before we start rolling back the kinds of protections and investments that we so sorely lacked at the very start.
Almost every aspect of the nation's program of pandemic management is now imperiled. The supply of new treatments for those most at risk, free testing and vaccinations for the uninsured, efforts to vaccinate people in poorer countries where new variants may arise, not to mention in our own backyard.
We've actually had XA, XB, XC. We talked about the Deltacron, which was Delta plus Omicron. Now these are two Omicrons together.
Young says that as the current pandemic drags on, the next one hurtles towards us. The lessons the U.S. have failed to learn are at least a century old. We'll get to those later in the hour. First, Ed Young. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
COVID's now the third leading cause of death in the U.S. The third leading cause.
January and February of 2022 were the fourth and fifth deadliest months of the pandemic to date. For about 6 months straight, the U.S. lost over 1,000 citizens every day. Where was the reaction that that level of death should have provoked? Why was it that in January and February, we had so much talk about returning to normal? We had op-eds claiming that the pandemic was over, that it was time to open everything again. It feels like COVID has become similar to a lot of other causes of mass mortality in the US. Gun violence is a classic example that people just accept as part of the background of our lives. You know, if you compare the death toll from COVID to things like terrorist attacks, to natural disasters like Hurricane Katrina, it's huge in scale. It's so much bigger in terms of the numbers. Why doesn't it provoke the same kind of visceral reaction?
Some of this has to do with fatalism, but you write that in the case of COVID, fatalism has been stoked by failure.
Yes. The U.S. went into this pandemic rated as the most prepared country for a pandemic in the world. And yet, across 2+ years and 2 separate administrations, it really did fail to control the pandemic. You know, before vaccinations, after vaccinations, that creates this sense of almost nihilistic abandonment, this feeling that you're going to get infected, we're just going to have to learn to live with it. That's the point a lot of people have got to.
Since almost the very start of the pandemic, the choices have been framed in terms of this ridiculous false dichotomy where either we like lock down all of society in this draconian way, or we do absolutely nothing and let the virus run amok. That's nonsense. There are so many things we could do in the middle space. You know, we could provide social policies like paid sick leave that would allow them to care for their livelihoods and their lives at the same time. We could improve the ventilation of our buildings. We could use mask mandates in a clever and targeted way. So they switch on, then they switch off according to very clearly defined metrics. We could do all of these things. And we just seem instead intent on pulling back all of these protections.
Is it a lack of preparedness or simply a matter of which lives matter?
Both of those things are interrelated. The deaths in the US have not fallen randomly across the country. They've been concentrated among marginalized communities. The elderly, people who are immunocompromised, Black and Hispanic and Indigenous communities, disabled people, all of these groups have disproportionately been killed by the coronavirus. The US is very good at looking past the disproportionate deaths of its most vulnerable citizens. There was a paper that came out very recently which showed that when white Americans are told about the racial inequities in COVID deaths, they are less likely to take the pandemic seriously, less likely to want to continue with mitigation measures. You know, these are groups who are marginalized in life and their deaths are being treated marginally too. White mortality during COVID was still lower than Black mortality was in the pre-pandemic years. And that speaks to the sheer amount of inequity that the US, you know, had already come to accept even before COVID happened. It's important to remember that people who are controlling the pandemic narrative, so journalists and policymakers, are predominantly not from these groups. They are predominantly from communities and positions of privilege, and are less likely to know people who have significantly borne the brunt of the pandemic. And I think that their decisions reflect that demographic bias too.
So let's talk about some of the rhetoric by public health officials and pundits and politicians that seems to add to the normalization of mass death. Mm-hmm. I mean, part of it has to do with a sense that this is a matter of personal responsibility.
Even Rochelle Walensky, the director of the CDC, the nation's premier public health agency, was talking about how your health is in your hands, you know, using the rhetoric of individual responsibility. Firstly, it's an infectious disease. It spreads from person to person. And so my health in the context of an epidemic is never fully in my hands. It also depends on the decisions of my neighbors. Mm-hmm. But also, your ability to make choices about your health are constrained by your circumstances. So if you work in a low-income job where you earn hourly wages and you don't have paid sick leave, you might not be able to isolate if you start having symptoms. You might not be able to find the time to go take a test or to make a vaccine appointment. This is something that public health officials, more than anyone, should understand, because the entire discipline is about protecting the health of entire communities. To understand that people are connected and their social conditions affect their health in profound ways. To see the rhetoric instead of individual choice above all else being echoed by some of the nation's top public health officials shows how much this strain of almost toxic individualism dominates American culture in a way that is really antithetical to actually controlling an infectious disease, which is by its very nature a collective problem.
You spoke to Richard Keller, who is a medical historian at the University of Wisconsin at Madison, and he said that a lot of the current pandemic rhetoric talks about comorbidities or treats death as so inevitable as to not merit precaution.
We see this a lot with some other causes of death, like liver disease or lung cancer or AIDS, where these diseases are billed as a person's own fault. Like if you die from lung cancer, it was your fault because you probably smoked. And similarly, there is this idea that if you die from COVID, it's your fault because you didn't get vaccinated. It really puts the onus of responsibility entirely on the individual who is sick and who has died, instead of all the broken systems that surround that person. And we've already talked about the ways in which income and personal circumstances affect your choices. But then there's all the rest of it. Like, do you blame the person who died of COVID for dying of COVID? Why not apportion that blame to the person who infected them, or the person who infected that person, or all the political choices that allowed the virus to run amok through the population? It's weird that all of those systemic problems and all of the chains of events that led to someone being infected are overlooked. You know, again, this is like part of the quite gross way we individualize sickness and then absolve people in positions of power for not doing the things that would have prevented mass infection and mass death.
Right. I agree with everything you've said, although there's a maybe a mean, small part of me that says, what about those people who didn't choose to be vaccinated?
That decision is also an issue of inequity. It's also an issue of access. And in this case, it's things like access to high quality information. It's access to medical providers who you trust.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't have those things. They might live in a rural community with no doctor who they regularly talk to. They may not have a doctor because they're uninsured. They might be surrounded by people who all are saying the same thing, which is that vaccines don't work and you shouldn't get them. I don't understand why it's okay to think that those people deserve to die. Just because people buy into false information doesn't mean we get to abandon them.
I appreciate that. Thank you. You also wrote, if safety is a matter of personal responsibility, then so is remembrance.
Aside from a few moments like Biden doing a lighting ceremony at the White House, there really have been almost no national acts of remembrance and mourning, you know, no permanent memorials. The lack of memorials or of national acts of mourning leaves grievers locked in their own grief and to deal with it on their own. And I don't think we should underestimate the cost of that. You know, if almost a million people have died, then that means that around 9 million people will be grieving a close loved one.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's a population larger than the majority of states. That's a huge number of people who are going through really intense loss right now.
We saw that as the weekly death count dipped, the CDC announced that fully vaccinated Americans no longer needed to mask indoors. The CDC, you observed, offered no advice to immunocompromised people who then became more at risk from simple activities like grocery shopping. And that's not a small group of people. There are at least 7 million of them in the U.S. You said that respecting the needs of immunocompromised people isn't about disproportionately accommodating some tiny minority. It's really about empathizing with your future self.
Right. One of the things that degrades our immune system is just aging. Our immune systems get weaker. And that's partly why elderly people are so much more vulnerable to COVID. So the kinds of measures that would protect immunocompromised people now are also the kinds of measures that would protect all of us as we get older and as our immune systems naturally weaken. We talked about how there are 7 million plus people who are immunocompromised in this country. If you include immunity weakening through age, that number gets a lot larger, a lot more quickly. And I think, you know, sometimes people who have the privilege of good health forget that that is a fleeting and precious thing, and that they are one diagnosis or one accident away from disability. You know, as an immunocompromised person said to me, like, don't you want a better world for yourself when that happens? The imminent future does not look great. If anything gives me a little bit of hope, it's the fact there are a lot of grassroots movements springing up right now to draw attention to communities who have been disproportionately harmed by the pandemic. I spoke to an anthropologist who studies communities after wars and conflicts, and she told me that this often happens. It's often the groups that have been disproportionately harmed who, you know, have to carry the mantle of moving their society towards a phase of reconciliation and reckoning. And you shouldn't have to be, you know, they've already suffered the most, but I'm not seeing signs that the more privileged among us are willing to carry that burden in their stead.
Ed, thank you very much.
No, thanks for having me.
Ed Yong is a staff writer at The Atlantic, where he covers science. Next, there are people out there who know exactly how to live a fulfilling life in a seriously infectious world. We don't listen.
We're not going to take into consideration this very real problem unless everybody considers it a problem, not just the people who are already suffering from it. You or I could be struck down with long COVID tomorrow. Many people in the world are unvaccinated, and we don't know what variants are going to come.
This is On the Media.